All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get started. Good morning. My name's Jonathan Curtis. I'm Assistant Secretary Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library, and a very warm welcome to you all to this year's budget seminar. The seminar, as advertised, will be in two parts. Daniel will be talking about the context of the budget, and in the second half, Daniel will be speaking about the budget papers and how to navigate them. Each session will go for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a question and answer session at the end. So I encourage you to hold your questions until then. So without further ado, I shall hand over to our speakers.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming along today. It's great to see so many people here with us today. My job this morning is to get you all warmed up, ready to talk budget papers with Daniel. And like all good support acts, I'll try not to take too much time. To do this, I'll be making some observations about the context for the budget this year, and I'll be trying to cover the global economic outlook, the Australian economy, the longer term, and I'll leave you with some questions. In the time available, it won't be possible to go into a great deal of detail. It'll be a case of once over lightly, but I hope you find the material interesting. It's always good to be able to start with some good news. And the good news is the global economic recovery finally looks like it's building some sustained momentum. Growth began to pick up in the second half of last year, and it looks like it's been sustained going into 2014. According to the OECD, key drivers of growth such as investment and trade are finally beginning to fire again. The advanced economies have accounted for much of the recent momentum, especially the United States. While downside risks have eased, they remain significant. This includes concerns about growth slowing in emerging market and developing economies and recent geopolitical tensions. The IMF, OECD and other commentators are stressing the need for structural reforms to address supply-side constraints, to create jobs and bolster growth. Structural reforms include creating more competitive and efficient markets for inputs and outputs, and investing more effectively in infrastructure and human capital. This is in the context of there being some uncertainty about what the potential pace of economic growth is going to be going forward, which is something I'd like to come back to later in my presentation. As you'd be aware, the IMF and OECD have recently released revised growth forecasts, and they tell a fairly consistent story. Global economic growth slowed in 2013 to around 3%, but is forecast to pick up in 2014 and strengthen further in 2015 to around 4%. The improved global outlook is being assisted by developments in the United States, where growth is forecast by the IMF to be around 2.75% in 2014. It's worth noting the OECD's more optimistic forecast for the United States in 2015, and it may be that the US surprises us on the upside. China's growth is forecast to slow marginally from 7.7% in 2013 to around 7.5% in 2014. This is consistent with China's transition to a more sustainable growth path. I wanted to draw your attention to some interesting work from Brookings. Brookings, in collaboration with the Financial Times, have developed TIGER. tracking indexes for the global economic recovery. Tiger tracks developments in some 25 economies, including the major advanced and emerging market economies. The researchers at Brookings released their latest update in April. I want to quickly look at charts of four of their composite indexes. Overall growth, the first one, real economic activity, financial market performance and confidence. The findings from the latest update are broadly consistent with the IMF and OECD's take on the global economy. Overall, world economic recovery has strengthened. Advanced economies are gradually gaining momentum, while emerging market economies seem to be cooling off somewhat. Advanced economies have also edged ahead marginally in terms of financial market performance, as well as measures of business and consumer confidence. Reflecting these developments, the Brookings researchers argue that policymakers in most major economies now have some breathing room to shift from defensive to growth-enhancing policies. They also emphasise the need for supply-side structural reforms to bolster long-term growth and facilitate the repair of public finances. If you're interested, Australia is one of the countries included in Tiger, and you can access charts tracking Australia's performance on the Brookings website. In terms of the Australian economy, I want to focus on the outlook for growth and the need to lift Australia's productivity performance. In recent times, growth has been solid but below trend. In 2012, the Australian economy was growing above trend at around 3.6%. It slowed markedly in 2013. to around 2.4% and is forecast by the IMF and OECD to grow by 2.6% in 2014. The Reserve Bank of Australia is slightly more optimistic, forecasting growth of 3% on a year average basis. As you'd be aware, a rebalancing of growth has been underway for some time. Resources sector investment is expected to decline sharply in coming years. Lower government spending will also weigh on growth. On the upside, increased resource sector exports will make a positive contribution to growth. And there are signs that retail spending and housing construction are strengthening in response to the low interest rate environment. However, non-resource sector business investment is still subdued, and a stubbornly high Australian dollar is making rebalancing more challenging. While things have gone pretty smoothly thus far, it's important to recognise that the Australian economy has yet to feel the full contractionary force of the fall in resources sector investment. The question is whether the pickup in other sources of growth will be sufficient to ensure that the economy makes a smooth transition. This chart is taken from the Reserve Bank of Australia's latest statement on monetary policy that was released last Friday. It puts some numbers on the rebalancing story I've just outlined, by showing how the composition of growth changed over the year to December 2013. You can see on the far left-hand side of the chart that overall growth slowed over the 12 months to December last year. As I said, on a year average basis, growth was running around 3.6% at the end of 2012, and it slowed to around 2.4% by the end of 2013. You can see that over this period, the contribution from mining investment swung from making a positive contribution to growth to slightly detracting from growth. Non-mining business investment also detracted from growth. Consumption made a positive contribution to growth. And there was a pickup in the contribution from exports and tentative signs of a turnaround in dwelling investment. Turning to productivity, this table is lifted from the Productivity Commission's latest productivity update. I just want to highlight the slowdown in multi-factor productivity, the MFP line. There are different measures of productivity, but multi-factor productivity is the one that comes closest to the underlying concept of productivity, the efficiency of producers in producing output using both labour and capital. If we look at the PC's numbers, we find that for the market sector, over the long term, 1973-74 to 2012-13, multi-factor productivity was increasing on average by 0.7% a year. In contrast, over the last decade, multi-factor productivity growth has been negative. Why does this matter? Because in the long run, productivity is the key driver of sustained growth in real incomes and hence living standards. In releasing the update, the chairman of the Productivity Commission, Peter Harris, argued, and I quote, "It is evident from the update that Australia's productivity performance has fallen well behind that of most other developed economies for more than a decade. There are various reasons for this, including differences in the rate of investment growth. But the picture painted in the statistics calls for strong policy attention, particularly in the current era where the recent record terms of trade will no longer support continued income growth." End quote. Productivity is a useful segue to considering the longer-term context for the budget. This is a list of things that are typically identified as shaping the longer-term outlook for the Australian economy. An ageing population, climate change, natural resource depletion, the economic rise of Asia, external shocks to the economy, and long-term structural change. Given this is pretty well trodden ground, I don't want to dwell on these issues today, but use the short time left to draw your attention to another interesting big picture issue coming out of the current economic debate. I think it's fair to say that the global financial crisis was not only a shock to economies around the world, but also to the economics profession. Internationally, the global financial crisis has sparked a rethink about the nature of economic growth. A key dimension of this debate is what the potential pace of economic growth will be. Will growth recover to what it was before the GFC, or are we entering a protracted period of lower growth? This debate has an interesting technological dimension. Pessimists argue the gains from the third industrial revolution associated with the computer and internet have pretty much been tapped. This is not to suggest that living standards won't continue to benefit from innovation in these areas, but that the pace of improvement will slow. In contrast, the optimists argue that we are on the verge of a fourth industrial revolution associated with the development and use of intelligent machines, which will be almost perfect substitutes for low and medium skilled labour. It is argued that this has the potential to deliver improved productivity in areas such as energy efficiency, transport, such as self-driving vehicles, medical care, and the customisation of mass production. You're probably asking, how is this relevant to the budget? Well, the pace of economic growth has important implications for government revenue and expenditures, and of course for future living standards. If the pessimists are right, Future budgets would be put under increased pressure, particularly in the context of an ageing population. As a community, we would likely face more difficult choices. If the optimists are right, stronger growth could be expected to take some of the pressure off the budget, but if growth is driven by further advances in automation, it may have important implications for the labour market, particularly low and medium skilled jobs, and distributional effects through higher returns to highly skilled labour and the owners of capital. Arguably, given the current uncertainty about future growth prospects, there's an even higher premium on ensuring the budget is supportive of long-term growth. Internationally, inequality and social mobility are attracting increased attention from economists. Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, has become an international bestseller. This chart gives you an idea of what we're talking about. The chart shows the share of income going to the top 1% of income earners over a long period for the US, Canada, the UK and Australia. Interestingly, for these four countries, income inequality declined in the period from around the end of the Second World War through to the end of the 1970s. Since then, income inequality has increased. If we look at the period since the end of the Second World War, we see Australia started out slightly more equal than the others, and the increase in income inequality since the early 1980s has been much less severe. This can largely be attributed to Australia's tax and transfer systems, which have helped spread the gains of economic growth. But renewed interest in the economic effects of long-term trends in inequality and social mobility are not confined to academia. International organisations such as the IMF, OECD and the International Labour Organization are also weighing in. Earlier this year, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, observed, and I quote, "Let me be frank. In the past, economists have underestimated the importance of inequality. They have focused on economic growth, on the size of the pie, rather than its distribution. Today, we are more keenly aware of the damage done by inequality. Put simply, a severely skewed income distribution harms the pace and sustainability of growth over the longer term. It leads to an economy of exclusion and a wasteland of discarded potential." End quote. Why do inequality and social mobility matter for growth? First, there's a risk that human capital, that is our skills and talents, will be wasted or misallocated. When inequality and social mobility become barriers to people realising their full potential, their economic contribution is likely to be lower than it otherwise would be. Second, increasing inequality and declining social mobility may affect the motivation, effort, and ultimately the productivity of the labour force, with adverse effects on efficiency and the growth potential of the economy. And third, inequality and a lack of social mobility may lock certain groups into a semi-permanent welfare class, creating a drain on resources. Related to this, it may also create greater pressure for remedial policies which are themselves detrimental to growth. This debate suggests that the distributional effects of the budget require careful consideration, not only in a social context, but also from a long-term growth perspective. What I hope I've imparted in the short time today is that the context for the budget is complex, encompassing as it does a variety of risks and opportunities. Given this, the budget deserves to be considered from a broad perspective and not just in terms of the headline deficit or surplus. While the bottom line is clearly important, it's not the whole story. Some questions you might want to consider are, How well does the budget manage the risks and opportunities we face? What trade-offs have been made? What are the long-term implications for economic growth and living standards? And finally, what has been left for another day? That's really all I wanted to say today. Thanks for your attention. And I'll pass over to Daniel to continue the presentation.
Okay, Robert's spoken a little bit about some of the longer-term issues, and I'd just like to focus it down a little bit more towards the current fiscal position, and then go on to look at some of the budget paper type issues. Okay, now, this is a representation of Australia's fiscal position on an underlying cash basis. That's the measure which the government prefers. And on the left-hand side, it's shown on a billions of dollars basis, and on the right-hand side, it's shown as a percentage of GDP basis. You can see that the Australian, the Commonwealth has moved into a significant deficit position of late, pretty much since the global financial crisis. In retrospect, most economists view this as a structural deficit position. And what I mean in retrospect is, in order to work out whether or not the government is in a structural deficit or a structural surplus position, one has to take out the cyclical variation in revenues and expenses. And look, that requires a degree of hindsight, and you have to look back and look at sort of revenue receipts with a degree of hindsight. You can see that, revenue receipts, the fiscal position has been quite strong previously, but at that time, there were relatively few economists who were saying we were actually in a structural surplus position. And now, you need a degree of hindsight to work out what the cyclical position of the budget is. The persistent deficits have caused an increase in Australia's debt, and that's been a very topical debate in politics. There are often two measures of debt used. One is net debt and one is gross debt. Now, gross debt just is the total value of the debt. Net debt is the total value of the debt less sort of liquid assets held by the Commonwealth. Both these numbers get used from time to time. It's not particularly helpful that different people prefer to refer to different different measures, but they both get used. You can see that Australia's debt has certainly increased since the sort of 2009-2010 on both measures. However, you can see that it is also significantly below the average of the advanced economies of the world. Now, I don't know, people express different views about whether or not this is problematic or not. I think that both sort of points of view have a degree of credence to them. I think that the strongest argument that it is a problem is that we've just had, as Robert's discussed, a mining investment boom. We've had very strong terms of trade, yet our net debt has increased. Essentially the opposite view is that, we have debt, but we're a long way below international averages, and it's not problematic. I don't think there's a definitive answer as to what the true position is. Okay. You can see here that I've just charted the government revenues as a percentage of GDP, and I've also put the 20-year average of government revenues as a percentage of GDP. You can see that during the sort of the 2000s, revenues were actually above the long-term average, and around the GFC they actually moved below the long-term average. This, I suppose, gives some support to the view that the structural deficit position is possibly a revenue issue. However, on the expenses side, or the payments side, you can see that there has been, in fact, an increase in expenditures during and post the GFC over and above the long-term average. So again, I don't think it's clear what the correct answer here is. There are competing factors which have meant that Australia has ended up in the fiscal position which we're in currently, and whether or not the fiscal position which we're in currently is actually problematic, well, I think that's a big question, and I don't think that there are clear answers. Okay. Just like to go on to some key concepts that are used in the budget papers. There are some sort of specific ideas which are used in the Commonwealth's budget papers which are not, you know, picked up in accounting or similar economic analysis elsewhere. The government actually has a degree of discretion about what it uses as its headline measure. So when the government is, saying whether or not it's in deficit or surplus, it actually has a degree of choice about what measure it uses. There is a headline cash measure which is reported in the budget papers. Now, this is simply the amount of cash that the government receives less the amount of cash that the government pays out in a given period. That's problematic, and it doesn't really represent the fiscal position of the Commonwealth particularly well. So whilst it's reported, it's not the headline measure. There's another measure which is called the fiscal balance, and this is actually used quite commonly amongst state governments and other internet and governments around the world. This is what's called an accrual measure of the budget, or of the fiscal balance, or the budget position. It's accrual in the sense that it really ignores the timing of cash payments and cash receipts, and it really looks at the point in time at which revenues are earned or revenues are expected to accrue to the Commonwealth, and the point in time at which expenses are incurred by the Commonwealth. An example of accrual accounting would be if the government went and bought a $10 million building. Under cash accounting, that would be a $10 million expense in the first year, and then there would be no cost associated with that for, say, 20 years or the life of the building. Under accrual accounting, if the government went and spent $10 million on a building, it wouldn't be considered to have incurred a $10 million expense. What it would do would be allocate that $10 million over the 20 years life of that building. So there would just be a small amount in each year that building was, you know, essentially depreciated. So it matches the economic, you know, activity to the point in time rather and ignores that cash effect. Now, what the Commonwealth actually uses, helpfully, is a third measure. It's called the underlying cash balance. Now, this mostly picks up the cash receipts and the cash payments of the Commonwealth. However, it abstracts out certain large transactions, such as cash received from asset sales, because the idea is that if it distorts the overall position of the Commonwealth if significant assets are sold and they receive money in a given year. But there is a slight preference, I think, amongst economists to look at cash measures because they're considered to... they don't require a degree of estimation. So we use the underlying cash balance, and if some of the media speculation about asset sales that may be announced by the government in this upcoming budget are correct, it may mean that there are sort of interesting deviations between these various measures. Okay. Just go on to... Now, the budget is really a balancing act between what the broader economy is doing and what the government is deciding to do. And there is a split, essentially, in a lot of the budget materials between policy decisions of the government, and these are things, and I've got some examples here, new expenditure, making a decision to sort of tighten eligibility for a program or make eligibility more easily accessible, or changing tax rules to increase revenue or change effects in arising from the tax system. These are all things which are within the control of the government, and they essentially... well, these are all things which are in the control of the government. You have... balancing that is what we would typically call parameter variations. Now, these are things which really relate to the broader economic context and what's actually happening in the economy. For example, corporate profits will actually impact on the amount of corporate tax revenues. Employment, the total level of employment will impact on GDP growth, but if people move from employment to unemployment, obviously there'll be more expenditure on unemployment benefits. And Medicare claims, without any change to the eligibility of Medicare, there's possibly a medium-term sort of expectation that costs will increase. So in order, if the government, for example, wanted to deal with increased Medicare claims, it would have to actually make a policy decision up under the first category to tighten eligibility. And it does seem from some media reports that that might be the direction they're going. Just to make it even more confusing, the government is maybe not exactly what you think it is. So when you hear that the government's... I don't know, is there? when you hear that the government's in deficit or surplus, you have to be quite clear about what part of the government you're actually thinking about. Now, in order to make essentially international data comparable amongst countries, and some countries have a large, say, government-owned sector with large, you know, a large portion of their economy is sort of government-owned corporations running, you know, factories and that type of thing. So the IMF has developed a framework for separating out different functions of government. Now, you can basically see there's a, up the top, there's the total public sector, and that's essentially everything under the control of the government. You see a split there at the top between public financial corporation sector and the total non-financial public sector. Now, over in that public financial corporation sector, you have government agencies that perform a financial function, and examples of those are the Reserve Bank of Australia, which is listed there, but also Medibank Private. Medibank Private is a public financial corporation because it's in the business of selling insurance, which is a financial activity. If you come over here, you'll see another split between the general government sector and the public non-financial corporation sector. Now, the general government sector is essentially what most people, I think the government is. It's public servants in offices in Canberra. It's someone working at a Centrelink office. It's the defence forces. So everything that's sort of governmental in nature, that we, what you typically think of as the government, is in that general government sector. Over here in the public non-financial corporation sector, these are things which are activities or entities which are undertaking a sort of a commercial-like activity of, that isn't of a financial nature, but which are owned by the government. In here, you'll have things like the National Broadband Network will be a public non-financial corporation. Now, when we have a budget deficit or surplus, what we're actually really talking about is the general government sector. So we're not talking about NBN, we're not talking about the Reserve Bank, we're really just talking about the general government sector. There are interactions here. Entities which make a profit will actually pay dividends back to the general government sector. So it's not totally unrelated, but just bear that in mind. Okay. And another concept which is used in the budget papers is the difference between administered activities or administered revenues and expenses and departmental revenues and expenses. Now, government departments are, well, many government activities are defined in legislation or they simply, there's really no discretion on in the way in which they might be conducted. So they're typically referred to as administered activities, and these are things which government departments, you know, public servants sitting in an office, they don't really have any discretion over how these activities are performed. They've simply got to be done according to the law or certain sort of policy parameters. Under here you see social security payments, which are and health and education funding. These are things which you know, people in the health department or the Commonwealth Education Department, the vast majority of the money which they expend, they have no discretion over. And on the revenue side, the Commonwealth Treasury actually receives all the revenues that go into the Consolidated Revenue Fund, which is, you know, close to $400 billion a year. They have no discretion over the way in which they can handle that money. They, by law, they simply have to place it in the revenue, the Consolidated Revenue Fund. So that is an administered revenue that comes into the Commonwealth. There's obviously a lot of large programs in here. but sometimes it doesn't quite capture what you're possibly looking for. There's another area of activity, which is the departmental activity, and this is, staff and wages and salaries of public servants, whether or not to buy a photocopier, what office building do you lease. These are the things over which the government has, or government departments have, a high degree of discretion. So when you hear about the efficiency dividend, for example, or cuts to the public service, what you're really hearing about is these cuts to the departmental side of agencies' budgets. Most of the sort of administered programs haven't been altered when you hear sort of, in inverted commas, cuts to the public service. Just to give you an indication of the relative size of these areas, administered expenses, and the Commonwealth budget is around it's a little over $400 billion a year. Administered expenses are, around 85% of that number, and departmental expenses are really only around 15% of that number. Okay. Now, I'm just going to go over the budget papers now. This is, I suppose, this is typically what's presented with the budget. There's always a little bit of discretion available to the government about how they present things, but they generally don't change too much from year to year. Of course, the budget is a bill, at its heart, it's a bill that is proposing to authorise expenditure of the Commonwealth, and therefore there's always an appropriation bill, and that's tabled in the Parliament. There are actually usually three, and I think this year there might be five, and there are certain sort of constitutional reasons why they have to use multiple bills. There is also, every year there are typically I've got media statements and glossies here, sorry if that's an inappropriate term, but or ministerial statements, sorry. Ministerial statements, they really typically are blue. They bring together, or this light blue, they typically bring together information on specific areas of government activity, but probably information that cuts across different portfolios. So typically there is a ministerial statement on foreign aid and a ministerial statement on regional development. And at other times, the government will release other ministerial statements. And glossies, I mean, it's the government's day. The government can present its information however it chooses. Sometimes they will put out essentially a short summary piece on a particular area of policy which they're interested in. This is a tax reform roadmap which the former government released in May 2013, so 2 years ago. But we don't know until the papers are actually tabled what other documents might be there. Okay, we'll just go over to the main budget papers. There are four main budget papers, and I'll pick up my budget paper number one from last year, and I'll say, I can't say when you see the document that looks like this, because this government has actually never quite liked the coloured budget papers, so they've decided to go back to the nice white budget papers. So when you see a white version of this evening, this document basically contains the big picture of the budget and economic position. The first sort of four statements are typically the economic and fiscal outlook, and there's generally a statement in there, statement number four, which typically addresses a sort of area of particular policy interest of. To be honest, that's actually, I think, written by Treasury typically, and it pulls out some interesting things which the Treasury Department thinks are worth discussing in the budget papers. You also go through revenue, expenses, net capital investment, assets, risks. Statement number 10, it was this year, is a very useful document. It actually has historic government expenditure revenue data all the way back to 1970, 1971. However, it may not be statement number 10 this year, because there's another statement that's been which will be in the budget papers this year. That's called the debt statement. The Charter of Budget Honesty Act was amended this year, and now the government is required to also produce a debt statement which will have information on the Commonwealth government securities on the issue, their face value, their market value, things like that. So I suspect that these this numbering here might change around, but budget paper number one, budget strategy and outlook, is really that big picture economic fiscal the paper. And just going through some of the information that you typically find in here, these are the government's or the Treasury Department's economic forecasts. These are from last year, but this essentially tells not just Parliament but also economists around the country and around the world what the Australian Treasury thinks are the economic prospects for the Australian economy going forward. You also have, in various places, you have measures of the overall fiscal and deficit or surplus position. And here you can see that these are there's both the underlying cash balance measure and the fiscal balance measure, which I referred to earlier. And you also have some interesting summary tables in there. This is a summary table which shows, this is from the former government, but this shows the effect of policy decisions on the fiscal position. This was a table that I think they added into the budget papers about halfway through the term, and I think they simply wanted to show what their policy making was doing to the overall fiscal position. Okay, the next paper is the budget measures document, and this is sort of the what's in the budget for me paper. This has all the good news and all the bad news, because I spoke earlier about the policy decisions versus the parameter variations. This has all the policy decisions of the government in it. So there are measures which affect the revenues, and they can affect them positively or negatively, so you can have a negative revenue measure. There's also expense measures, and there are capital measures. Capital measures are pretty limited, but there are certainly some capital measures at the back of BP2. It doesn't pick up this broader economic variation in revenues and receipts. It really is just a list of all the individual government decisions which have been made in a given year. Now, each individual measure will have a descriptor like this. They're reasonably succinct and reasonably easy to understand, I think, but you can see here that this is an expense measure. It's in the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, which it was last year. You can see that it's a negative expense measure, so it's a decision by the government to spend less, and it has a description of what the effect of that program is. Here you have a revenue measure from last year. It's related to the Bureau of Meteorology. You can see it has NFP in there, and this is about website advertising, and you can, in the description it says, we're not going to publish our estimates of how much revenue we're going to get for this because we don't want to compromise our sort of negotiating position when we go out and try to commence advertising. You can also see here that in order to obtain this revenue that they haven't disclosed, there's also some associated costs that they anticipate. So there's a related expense there of sort of $300,000 a year. And BP2 captures all the decisions of the government that have an effect on revenues, expenses or the capital of the government. This is a revenue measure around sort of miscellaneous tax laws. You can see here that it's got a brief description of what they're doing, but you can see in the table that they actually just have two dots there. That two dots means that it's not equal to zero, but it rounds to zero, or their best estimate is that the net effect of this is zero. So you will see measures in the budget paper number two, which it's the announcement of a government decision, but it doesn't have any cost associated with it, or they're unable to estimate what the cost is. I'll go a bit quicker. And this is just another capital measure. Okay. The next paper is the Australia's Federal Financial Relations. I can probably go through this quite quickly, but there are essentially two types of... out of that $400 billion expenditure of the Commonwealth each year, around $95 billion is actually transferred straight to state and territory governments, and some of it is associated with health, education, and a range of other range of other policy areas. So if you are trying to work out, for example, how much the Commonwealth spends on healthcare in a given year, it's possibly misleading simply to go and look at the health, the Federal Health Department's budget. You also possibly have to pick up some of this money which is going through to the states. So I think there's about 40 or so billion in these specific purpose payments, and BP3 has quite detailed information about estimates of how much each individual jurisdiction will receive under those various programs. And here's some of the summary tables in there. So if you're interested in health, and in WA in 2015-16, you can get really good information out of that. There's also information in here about the GST and how much revenue each individual state is forecast to receive. So you might be familiar with the GST relativity. WA, I think, has made a lot of noise about it and said, well, we're only going to get so many cents in the dollar back. There are tables and estimates of what those relativities in the will be going forward, and there's also an estimate of the overall amount of GST revenue that is anticipated to be collected. And there are also summary tables, so that's a very important source of information. The fourth budget paper is agency resourcing. To be honest, and I think it's probably one of the most difficult and least useful, I was going to say unhelpful, least useful budget papers. It does have very technical, specific information in it about what is going to each individual agency under each individual appropriation bill. It's all, you know, accurate, useful information, but it's very inaccessible. And if you are interested in individual agencies' funding and resources, there are probably better places to go. And that better place is probably the portfolio budget statement. Now, each portfolio will have a portfolio budget statement, and they've been yellow for a long time, and I don't think they're going to change this year. This basically contains a set of financial statements for each individual agency within a portfolio. So in the Treasury Department, you will have the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, you'll have the Australian Tax Office. Every agency which falls under that Treasury portfolio will have a section in here. Now, this section will provide, this paper for each individual agency will show what's here called the resource statement. This captures every resource which is available to that agency. There is a line here which is often appears, which is, it's called Section 31 receipts. Now, that's a coded way of saying money that the agency collects from user charges or selling its services, which it's able to retain and use. So that's one of the few places you can pick up on that information. And then this is basically the best source of information regarding what's available to each individual agency. Portfolio budget statements also have information on what's called outcomes, and each agency doesn't just get given money, it gets given money to achieve certain outcomes. Now, each individual outcome will either have a program or multiple programs underneath it, and as part of being given money for delivering an outcome, each individual agency will be required to have performance measures on how well that outcome is being delivered, and will be required to report at the end of the year and report in these budget papers about how they've progressed those programs and outputs in the last year. So if you're interested in, for example, how many clients Centrelink serviced in a given year, there should be at least some type of information in the relevant PBS regarding the number of clients, average wait times and things like that. So if you're interested in individual programs or the performance of an agency, this is a very good place to look. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry we're running a little over time, but we now have time for questions. Those who do need to run off, please do. But do I have any questions from the floor?
Yeah, so if you want to find out whether the specific program's been funded or not,
yes.
The inaccessible one would be the one to look at, is that right? BP4?
No. You first have to work out which portfolio that program.
The Department of Social Services,
yes.
Sort of like a number of community services programs.
The best place I think would be to go to the Department of Social Services portfolio budget statement,
right.
And there have been what are called administrative arrangement order changes. So when this new government came in, certain functions moved between departments, so it can sometimes be difficult to work out which portfolio a program is in. But if you do know what portfolio or program is in, you should basically be able to find information on that program within that portfolio budget statement.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. If a program that's been split, like the community investment program that used to be under DSS,
yes.
3 of the 4 streams are still under DSS, but 1 stream is moved out of the Prime Minister and Cabinet.
Yes.
How would you track that year on year across the state?
There is typically a reconciliation provided. However, if you cannot find a reconciliation in the portfolio budget statements which are released today, that may be because at the point when this government released the MIEFO document, they reflected a lot of those administrative arrangement order changes, and you may have to go back to a document which is called the Portfolio Additional Estimates Statements, which are released at the point of MIEFO. So if you're having a problem tracking a program from the former government and under the former administrative arrangement orders through to what's released this evening, it may be that in around the time of MIEFO, an updated one of those yellow books was released that actually has the reconciliation showing where particular functions are.
Last year's budget, MIEFO, or initial estimate statements, and this year's budget, but you should be able to see the movement somewhere in there if it's not on the document.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Sorry if I'm missing anyone.
Just in the organisational chart that was on the screen, where would you put an organisation like the Mint? Would it be public non-financial, or would it be in the general section?
The classification works on a sort of a decision tree, if I recall, and one of those questions is whether or not the agency is pursuing a profit objective, a profit motive. So if you go through that decision... My understanding currently is that the Mint is not seeking to make a profit, it's simply performing a government service. So I would suspect that currently it would be part of the general government sector. However, if the government made a sort of administrative decision or provided a direction that the Mint had to move to a profit-making objective, and they did that in order to sell it, that would probably mean it would have to go over to that public finance, non-financial corporation sector. But there is a reconciliation in, I think, statement. There's a table that explicitly states which sector each individual entity is in, and I think it is in statement number 9 of Budget Paper 1.
All right. I think we're out of time, and I think we've run out of questions as well. So thank you all very much for attending, and good luck with Budget Day.
Thank you. That's all right.
I'm Commander of the
Kitchen. Yes. More happy to help you. Problem is, I'm thinking the audience of being
It's not quite capable.